Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Learn about English usage with words and their stories. Then, a report on soccer and its fans. And hear a story about the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. But first, our higher education report.
Kwame Wiridu thought he had all the education he would need when he successfully completed his medical degree program. The 28-year-old is from the city of Kumasi in the West African nation of Ghana. He earned a bachelor's degree from Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Kumasi in 2010. Then, in 2013, he received his medical degree from the same school. But in the next few years, several things happened while Wiridu was practicing medicine that led him to seek more training. In 2014, several countries near Ghana, including Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, experienced widespread cases of the Ebola virus. The virus is extremely dangerous and spreads easily. Yet Wiridu noted that Ghana's leaders were doing little in the way of emergency preparations. Then, in 2015, Wiridu noticed doctors in his country refusing to work because of poor working conditions and lack of government support. He says this made him question the abilities of Ghana's leaders to deal with major public health issues.
If this happens somewhere else, like in the U.S., you see all the media coming in to help, you see all the practitioners putting their minds together to do something to mitigate the impact. But with all these cases, the health policymakers were more of economists than people who had that touch with the health. So I asked myself, how different would it be if you have a health policymaker who also has the health background?
Wiridu says he decided then that if he wanted better public health policies, he would have to help his leaders make them. And to do that, he says, he needed to be more informed himself. So Wiridu decided to go back to school, this time in the United States. He entered the University of Denver in 2016 to seek a master's degree in international relations and health policy. The University of Denver, or DU, is a private research university in the city of Denver, the capital of the American state of Colorado. It was established in 1864 and serves about 11,600 students. Wiridu says his interest in the school grew when it offered him a large amount of financial assistance. But he says he found the promise of a high-quality education at DU even more appealing. The Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at DU offers programs that explore the larger health policy issues that interest Wiridu. He says the school's strong infrastructure also won him over. And he says the small number of students per professor helped make his learning experience feel more personal. However, Wiridu adds that his time in the U.S. has not been without difficulties.
The majority of American colleges and universities divide their yearly terms into two study periods called semesters. They are each usually 3 to 4 months long. But some schools, like DU, break their terms into shorter periods called quarters, each about 10 weeks. Wiradu says that with such a short study period, the classes move quickly and students can easily fall behind in their work. Also, Wiradu says that people in Ghana do not treat others differently based on the color of their skin. It was only after he came to the United States that he experienced racism, he says. For example, during his first winter in Denver, Wiradu went to a store to buy some warm clothing with an American friend. Afterwards, his friend pointed out that an employee had been following them the entire time they were in the store. His friend suggested it was because they are both black. The situation was hard for Wiradu to understand, but he says he started to experience similar incidents more and more.
It is still a difficult thing for me to grasp until someone draws my attention that, hey, this could be an act of racism. So how it has affected me, I would say that it is difficult for me to assess.
For Tanya Tanyaratnan, stories like Wiradu's are a call to solve problems like hatred and mistrust between different people. The 19-year-old says she hopes to do so little by little by teaching people to enjoy and respect cultures they may not fully understand. Tanyaratnan is from Nakhon Pathom, Thailand, a town just outside of Bangkok. In 2014, she entered an international student exchange program. She spent her second year of high school at Boulder High School in Boulder, Colorado. The young Thai says she found Americans to be mostly open-minded. She says the family she lived with in Boulder were very welcoming. So much so, in fact, that Tanyaratnan's parents wanted her to be near that family when she decided to attend university in America. So Tanyaratnan entered DU in 2017 to seek a bachelor's degree. And, like Wiradu, she was interested in international relations.
Tanyaratnan says she soon realized that a lot of American students at DU had little understanding of Thai culture.
I have been asked so many questions about my country, about my religion. I feel like many people have heard of Thailand, but they don't know a lot about Thailand. Like, we have cool temples, we have elephants, but what about other things?
Tanyaratnan says instead of being insulted by such questions, she saw a chance to educate people. So, she and some other students formed a Buddhist student group. The group holds cultural events and welcomes others to take part in some Buddhist traditions. Tanyaratnan says sharing cultures is an important part of being a citizen of the world, a role she has learned to value highly through her experience at DU. Kwame Wiradu expresses similar satisfaction with his higher education experience in America. He says his relationships with professors and fellow students far outweigh any difficulties. Wiradu plans to continue his education at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire in the fall. He still plans to use all he learned at the University of Denver and all he will learn at Dartmouth to help people everywhere. He says the good that will come from that will, with hope, outweigh the prejudices he faced in America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, Words and Their Stories, a program from VOA Learning English. On this program, we take English expressions and explain where they came from and how to use them.
In all languages, animals often find themselves in the center of many common expressions. English is no different. Today, we focus on the goat.
People have been dealing with goats for a long time. A website on the history of goats, The Goat Guide, says their story dates back many centuries. It claims that people began using the animals as food over 9,000 years ago. Goats are nosy, social animals. They are strong and can live in any number of environments. They can eat almost anything and a lot of it.
Among all domesticated animals, goats probably have the most going for them. Milk from goats never costs a lot, and goat milk is easy for the body to digest. Their meat is tasty and can be prepared in different ways. In addition, goat hair is used to make some of the finest and softest clothing money can buy. With such a long history and so much going for goats, you would think that English has many expressions with the word goat.
But it doesn't. We only found two. And one is just a noun, the word goatee. Now, goats have small tufts of hair on the lower part of the face. So a goatee is facial hair in about the same part of the chin on a man. It looks a little like the beard on a male goat.
The Merriam-Webster Dictionary claims that the word goatee first appeared in 1841. At that time, a goatee only meant hair growing on a man's chin, much like a goat's. However, by the 1990s, the word had come to mean any facial hair that is on the chin but not higher up on the cheeks. So it also involved men wearing a mustache. Some would argue, and people who study men's facial hair do, that a true goatee is only hair on the chin.
The next goat-related expression is more interesting: to get someone's goat. Hearing this expression the first time, you might think it means to steal someone's goat, but that is wrong.
If someone gets your goat, they make you angry. But why?
That's a good question. The answer is, we're not so sure. A dictionary of slang and unconventional English says that to get someone's goat may come from the French expression prendre le chèvre, which means to take the goat. Apparently, one way people could get milk was from a goat. So naturally, taking the animal would anger its owner.
Another explanation has to do with horse racing. In the 1900s, people who trained horses were said to have put goats near racehorses to keep them calm. Just before the race, the goat was removed. This would, supposedly, make the horse nervous and ready to run. However, there is no evidence to support this explanation. People who study languages for a living have a name for it: folk etymology. Another term for it is an urban legend.
In earlier times, to get your goat had another meaning. If something got your goat, it could have made you nervous or worried. In his book, Smoke Bellow, American writer Jack London tells the story of two men crossing a bridge that is very high off the ground. The lead character, Smoke, makes it safely across and shouts a warning back to the other.
Your turn, he called across. But just keep a-coming and don't look down. That's what got my goat. Just keep a-coming, that's all. And get a move on. It's almighty rotten.
Here he means looking down made him feel frightened. Americans don't really use the expression in this way any longer. It is a good example of how the meaning of an expression can change over time.
Let's talk about some other words that mean the same as got someone's goat. We have already used the word annoy. Some similar words are aggravate, bother, and bug. You can also irk and vex someone. So something that gets your goat is irksome or vexing. And if someone has gotten your goat, you could also say he or she has rubbed you the wrong way.
With all of these expressions, it can be an action that gets your goat or a person who gets your goat. Let's say you work with someone who doesn't clean up after herself. You can say she really gets your goat. Or if you want to make it less personal, you can say, it really gets my goat when she makes a mess at the coffee machine.
Now, if something often gets your goat or rubs you the wrong way, it can become a pet peeve. Pet peeves are those seemingly small things that get on your nerves. While a person can get your goat or get on your nerves, he or she cannot be called a pet peeve. But their actions can. For example, one pet peeve of mine is when one person takes up two seats on a crowded train, especially if a pregnant woman or older adult needs a seat. Is it a big deal? No, but it gets my goat nonetheless.
And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. So, what gets your goat? What rubs you the wrong way? Do you have any pet peeves? Let us know in the comments section.
I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
The 2018 FIFA World Cup continues to produce excitement and some major upsets for soccer fans worldwide. No matter which team you favor, there are likely to be ups and downs throughout the competition. But the biggest World Cup winners seem to always be the sellers of football jerseys. Two of the world's biggest jersey manufacturers are American-based Nike and Germany's Adidas. Adidas chief Kasper Rorsted predicted last month his company would sell more team shirts this year than during the 2014 World Cup. If he is correct, this means Adidas would beat its record of 8 million jerseys sold in 2014. Sales of jerseys and other soccer-related items are also rising for Nike. The Oregon-based sports clothing company is hoping to increase the $2 billion it sold in soccer-related items last year, Reuters news agency reports. Nike got off to a good start when its jersey design for Nigeria's team sold out just a few minutes after going on sale June 1st. That was after Nike had already sold 3 million of the shirts in pre-sales. The jerseys cost about $90. Many fans and clothing critics have praised the Nigerian jersey design for using bright colors and designs in an unusual way. The shirt has a green wing pattern on the front with a similar black design extending out onto the arms. Some fans commented that the jersey seemed to reimagine the Nigerian team's design from 1994, the first time the country entered the World Cup. In addition to Nigeria, Nike also supplied the designs for 9 other World Cup teams. These include Brazil, France, England, and Croatia. Adidas provided jerseys for 12 of the 32 teams, including Germany, Japan, Belgium, Sweden, Spain, and Russia. Simon Doonan is a super soccer fan and the writer of the book Soccer Style: The Magic and Madness. While the World Cup can be intensely competitive, Doonan believes it can also unite people the same way a jersey can. He said huge numbers of people come together to watch the World Cup, but with very strong feelings on all sides. So these things are going on at the same time. It's a sweet thing, because that's just life, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Tornillo, Texas is a small farming community in the southwestern United States. It sits along the Mexican border, a short drive from the city of El Paso in West Texas. A month ago, the federal government chose Tornillo as the place to set up 450 beds for immigrant children. The small town is providing temporary housing for children who were separated from their families as a part of the government's policy on migrants. More than 350 youngsters moved in on June 14th. Since then, the town has become the center of a national debate over illegal immigration. The 1,600 citizens of Tornillo have seen thousands of protesters and near-daily visits from officials at all levels of government. U.S. lawmakers, Texas officials, human rights activists, and others have gone there and visited the children, mostly teenage boys. At the same time, local farm workers continue their daily routine. Some water crops as buses carrying immigrant children pass through Tornillo. It's a peaceful town. Not a lot goes on, Pablo Barcenas told the El Paso Times newspaper. It's a nice place to grow up. You can go outside and ride your bike. Everybody knows everybody, he added. Barcenas lives and works about 400 kilometers away, in Odessa, Texas, but returns to Tornillo as often as he can. He said he was unhappy by the new tent city and the politics behind it. Last month, President Donald Trump signed an order to end the policy of separating children from parents accused of entering the U.S. illegally. As a result, the military is preparing nearby Fort Bliss and Goodfellows Air Force Base to house tens of thousands of asylum seekers and illegal immigrants who crossed the border as families. Last week, a federal judge in California ruled that the government must quickly reunite migrant children with their parents. The Tornillo shelter is set to close in July after the children are returned to their families. In town, few people will ask out loud why their small, quiet community was chosen to house the immigrant families. County Commissioner Vince Perez called the tent city disturbing and said it will likely cause long-lasting psychological harm to the children. This is a practice that really amounts to government abuse, and in many respects, I feel, a form of psychological torture, he said. Perez added that he visited the shelter back in 2016, when it was first created to house immigrant families that had been arrested. The tents are air-conditioned and weren't ideal conditions, but the federal government was trying to do something to help address the influx of Central American migrants coming to the U.S., Perez said. But it was keeping the family unit together while it awaited a civil hearing. Perez said he and his office are trying to get as much information as possible to see if they can assist with reuniting the children with their parents. Former state representative Inocente Chente Quintanilla also is critical of the tent city. He believes Tornillo was chosen because of its new port of entry, which opened in late 2014. Illegal immigration is a difficult issue in a town where half of locals are foreign-born, according to U.S. Census Bureau records. I have mixed feelings because I know what my dad went through to bring us to the United States, Quintanilla said. We were here illegally for 8 years. Quintanilla's father was a farm worker, and his family lived on the land where he worked. In 1951, his father was told if they moved back to Mexico, they could begin the process to get visas and live legally in the United States. At the time, Quintanilla was in the first grade. The Border Patrol came and picked us up and took us to a house my dad had built in Caseta, Mexico, just across the border from Tornillo, he said. It took almost a year to fix the papers. Mario Garcia, 75, who has lived in Tornillo for 25 years, also understands the difficulties. He came to the United States illegally after his family's store burned down in Mexico. Garcia went from working in a store to working in the fields of California. He later became a U.S. citizen. At work, he became a supervisor, responsible for up to 5,000 workers. I can't say anything good or bad about the immigration situation, he said. When one is in dire need, you want to do anything to improve the situation, he said. Maybe in another place, you think I can find food, and where I am at, I could die. When you're in that situation, you're trying to do something for the future of your children, not yourself. I'm Lucia Malonig.
And that is our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from America and around the world.